Now this morning our session is going to be on how to exercise sound judgment. And then we're going to take up such subjects as priorities, how to determine what priorities are, how to make a decision, how to conduct a conference, how to set up a sound organization, and subjects like that. Is that okay? Then, of course, we're always open for suggestions from the floor, too. I think one of the simplest concepts of leadership is simply this. Leadership is accomplishing our objectives through the efforts of others, or at least utilizing the efforts of other people. That sound all right? You'd like to discuss that any? When God gives us a conviction that there's something to be done and He wants us to do it, we just can't get away from the fact that this involves support from somebody else. So leadership, we get our objectives accomplished, all of them, utilizing the efforts of other people. Now, down through the years, there, as leadership has been studied, many, many authors have put together what they considered qualities that a leader must possess. But at the close of World War II, some studies were made which almost rendered this concept obsolete. And I want to give you some statistics that came out of the Military Academy at West Point that I think confirms this. Now, I'm going to read most of this verbatim. Until World War II, research and leadership had been concerned primarily with studying the personalities of leaders. It was thought that leaders had personal characteristics that made them different from their followers and enabled them to become leaders. It was further thought that men who did not have these characteristics could not generally become successful leaders. You agree with that at this point? A large amount of research was done in an attempt to identify these personality characteristics and to discover how they enable men to become successful leaders. However, these research efforts turned out largely to be fruitless. It gradually appeared evident that personality characteristics could not be used to distinguish the leader from the non-leader. There were several reasons for this. And we have three of them here. The first one is, some followers usually possessed the same personality characteristics their leader possessed to a small or even greater degree. The second finding, that personality characteristics found for leaders in one situation were not necessarily found for leaders in another situation. And the third thing here, within the same kind of leadership situation, leaders differed from one another in many important respects, even to a greater degree than they differed from their followers. So this kind of complicates the situation, doesn't it? So there has to be a different basis other than personality characteristics for evaluating what leadership consists of. Now here's the conclusion. After some further studies were made, it became clear that a leader's success depends not nearly so much on his personality characteristics as on the bent to which his action facilitates the attainment of group goals. Thus, if the leader's actions help the group achieve its goal, his influence within the group was great, and he was judged to be a good leader. we'll discuss this a little bit more, but within the group, if he could help the group attain their goal, he was a good leader. If the leader's action did not help in achieving of group goals, his influence decreased, and he was judged to be a poor leader. If the group was free to reject his leadership, it usually did. This concept of leadership and the leadership process clearly has far-reaching implications for leadership training. It indicates that the same kind or style of leadership will not be equally effective in different kind of situations, in that the leader to be effective must learn to pattern his actions to the demand of the situation. About everybody that's been interested in the field of leadership has done some research and written some books on the subject. I think the Air Force has probably the simplest conclusion. And in deciding who is a successful leader, the Air Force asks two questions. And the first one is, did he accomplish his mission? Not too concerned about his personality characteristics. Did he accomplish his mission? And the second question is, did he utilize all available resources in accomplishing his mission? Now, I wonder why they asked that question. Well, in order to be entrusted with a bigger mission, he has to know how to use all of his resources. If he only used a third of them, maybe that's his limit. Maybe he doesn't know how to use beyond that. Now, one other thought here. There are many different specific reasons why men are not effective leaders, just as there are different reasons why men are effective leaders. Some ineffective leaders are uncertain. Some are indifferent to the welfare of their men. Still others are overly concerned about their men. To these weaknesses could be added many others. The important question is whether, in the study of these weaknesses, there lies a key to understanding the basis for failure. And there are two underlying reasons. And here they are. An inability to analyze the situation that confronts him so that he is unable to arrive at the appropriate course of action. Now, if the situation isn't accurately sized up and analyzed, then the proper course of action is not going to be prescribed. And the second thing is an inability to implement the appropriate action once it has been identified to an accurate analysis of the situation. If it has been accurately analyzed, in other words, then he doesn't know what to do about it. Yes, the first one I don't think I could repeat it exactly, but the way it's written down here, an inability to analyze the situation that confronts him. So that he is unable to arrive at the appropriate course of action. And the second one, I'll rephrase this differently than I had it before. Once an accurate analysis of the situation has been made, and inability to take appropriate action. So, according to what we have here, the greatest cause for failure to accomplish a mission lies in the realm of sound judgment. This is what happens. Now we're going to take up five or six things here which affect sound judgment. Sound judgment is simply the ability to weigh the evidence and come up with the right answer. Now, we're going to get into a detailed discussion here in a little bit. But one of the most important factors necessary to exercise sound judgment is to have information. I cut something out of a magazine several years ago and kept it on my desk for a long time. And this little drawing said, "A man's judgment is no better than his information." During the month of December, right after the election in 1952, after General Eisenhower had been elected president, he mentioned that he was going to take a trip to Korea for the purpose of trying to terminate the war. He took with him Charles Wilson, who had been designated as the Secretary of Defense. On their way out to Korea, they stopped several places, and their briefing on the Pacific was going to be given by Admiral Radford, who was the commander-in-chief of that area. So after dinner, they went in a map room on Okinawa, and Admiral Radford took an hour with his pointer, and he showed them every trouble spot in the world on this world map, and then showed how that his command related to it, what it could do and what it couldn't do. Without any notes or anything, he just got it. Well, I used to work for him, and you hardly ever saw him at the headquarters in Pearl Harbor. He was always traveling. And two-thirds of his staff at Pearl Harbor, the headquarters, were in the intelligence business, getting information. After this interview was over, or this presentation was over on Okinawa, Charles Wilson turned to Eisenhower, and he said, "That's the man I want for the chief of the staff, joint chiefs of staff, as a joint chiefs of staff." And Eisenhower, who knew quite a bit, was so impressed with his grasp of the situation, he turned to the senior man in his party and said, "Have we got room for him on the plane? I want him to go with us the rest of the trip." Well, they didn't have room, but they bumped one of their high-ranking civilians off the plane, and Admiral Radford accompanied him, and he came on back to Washington and became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where he served. Actually, he had been in pretty bad with the military because he had been the chief of naval operations when the Air Force and the Navy had a little competition there at one time. But both of these men, Eisenhower and Charlie Wilson, were impressed with his grasp. And they figured he was probably the best informed man in the military on what the situation was. So with all this information, they felt he could make some good judgments on problems. So information is the key to sound judgment, provided that a person is stable. I don't think we can say that one person's judgment is any better than another, but one person has more information. He knows all the factors. And I know in our work here in the office, some things come to me for decision. Some things go on to Lauren Sandy for decision, and I tell the people work for me. Now, it isn't that I'm any smarter than you are on this, but I may have information that affects this decision that you don't have. So there's certain things I want to bring to me just because I'm in a position to get information from certain areas that you don't. So this is a very, very important factor in making good judgment, is to have all the information about the situation. Anybody want to question this or say anything more about it? Now, you're going to see what I'm working up to here a little bit. One of the things that can affect judgment is prejudice. Now, if I were to tell you right now that Harry Truman, the historians will evaluate him as the greatest president that the United States has ever had up to this point, and that Dwight Eisenhower is the worst, I could probably divide the class here into two camps. Couldn't I? Because you've got your mind made up about Harry Truman as a person and about Dwight Eisenhower as a person. And if you've got your mind made up, it'd be pretty hard to get you to evaluate information accurately. Now, I think I'll just test this out a little bit, and you may say that I'm prejudiced. In the realm of foreign policy, historians will evaluate that Harry Truman never made a mistake. He never made a single mistake in all of his term in office. And he did more to prevent the spread of communism than anybody has ever done. While on the other hand, Dwight Eisenhower opened the door for communist expansion. Now, the way the historians evaluate how great a leader a person is how did the leadership of his country affect the rest of the world? All right, I'll just test this a little bit. The first thing that happened under Harry Truman's administration, although it had begun under a previous administration, was the formation of the United Nations. He's the man that got this going. The communists were depending upon the post-war depression to take over the United States, France, and all these other countries that had been in the war. That which prevented the communist takeover and a depression was the Marshall Plan. And in the Marshall Plan, actually, there's a little more to it than a lot of people. Some people don't realize. One of our senators from Colorado is one of the greatest economists that Congress has ever had. And at a committee hearing one day, somebody asked him, they saw on there this Marshall Plan aid here was $40 million worth of cigarettes. And this other member of the committee says, I can't figure this out. Why $40 million? Why not $39 million? And why not $41 million? How in the world did they arrive at a round figure of $40 million? So Senator Milliken said, well, you need to be checked out on the laws of economics. And what he said was, at the close of World War II, the administration had certain factors in our economy take inventories. of what they had on hand, and said, how long must you continue to make this product before you can shift over to a peacetime, gear over to a peacetime economy? So they took an inventory of all the surplus we had on hand and all we were going to produce in the gearing over period, and this is what made up the list for the Marshall Plan over in Europe. So the main thing this did, we had some humanitarian things in mind, but it kept our economy strong as we shift over to peacetime. So Senator Milligan says that's the inventory. That's where that figure came from. That's the amount we want to get rid of. So the Marshall Plan. Then the Berlin Airlift. Aid to Greece. The Korean War. CETO. These various things. So historians will evaluate that in the realm of foreign policy, under this man's leadership, there wasn't a single mistake made. Now, the United States had a firm policy on communism, and that was containment. It won't spread an inch. And so any time that it tried to spread, although there was a constant threat of war, this was the administration's policy. When the new administration came in, the first thing to do was bring the boys home to Korea, settle it at any price. So they partitioned it. Vietnam, partitioned it. Cuba, you know what happened down there? Sponsored a communist revolution down there. So communism began to make strides under the next administration. Now, most of you are prejudiced against Harry Truman as a person, aren't you? So you ask the question, what kind of leader was he? Well, I don't like his personality. I don't like anything that he did or said. But you check up on what some of the historians have to say as to his leadership in foreign affairs. He made the greatest impact on the world that any American president has ever made. And a few people accused him of being a communist. Now, do I illustrate what I'm talking about? Prejudice can affect your judgment. Can it? In just one realm. Now, another thing that affects judgment is the presence or lack of courage. And this is where that the leaders and the followers begin to separate. We know what's right, but we don't have the courage to carry it out. There are three main reasons that it's difficult to exercise courage and sound judgment. And one of the greatest of these factors is social pressure. You think a person can be a successful leader that responds to social pressure? Well, maybe we'll discuss this more in detail in a little bit. Another factor that affects sound judgment is expediency. Let's take the line of least resistance. Did you ever run out of gas? I mean literally, your automobile. Well, if you did, it probably wasn't because you didn't know the tank was getting low, but it was inconvenient to stop for gas. Now, the other factor that we'll discuss in some detail is what we call legality. And so instead of exercising initiative and sound judgment, Well, that's the law. You know, that's what the book says. That's what I've been told to do. So I can escape any responsibility. I'm on the safe side. I'll just resort to legalism. Now, I think we'll take these up in a little bit more detail. But I want to go back to this matter of information. Evaluate. And there's a good discussion of this in an article that was in the Nation's Business in 1962 called Test Your Judgment. So we're going to have a test here after I give a little background. But let's look at the background here. Good judgment requires careful distinction between two kinds of ideas we have about the world around us. These are called observations and inferences. Observations are products of personal experience. To observe something, we need to see, hear, feel, smell, or taste it. Inferences are decisions made, are decisions about the meanings of our observations. Both kinds of ideas are indispensable to our proper functioning, but when we mistake inferences for observations, we have trouble. Now, here's an illustration. In our language, it is easy to make observations and inferences sound alike. You arrive at the office one morning and find that your desk has been moved to a less desirable location. You may say to yourself, "My desk has been moved." You may also say to yourself, "My job is in danger. I'm slipping." Now, which is a proper observation? My desk's been moved. But immediately, this is an important thing. You see, there's subjective things comes in. These two statements are so much alike in form that many men find it difficult to realize how completely unlike they are in content. Their difference can be brought out by rephrasing them. The first could be made, "I see that my desk has been moved." This is a matter of simple, direct observation. If you can trust your eyes and your memory of the desk's previous location, it comes as close to certainty as the human mind is able to come. The second statement could be made, "I suspect that my job has been endangered." This is a matter of inference. The likelihood that the job is in danger needs further consideration and checking against other evidence. But this checking is made difficult, or even impossible, by failure to note that there is a fundamental difference between the observation and the inference. Failure to recognize this distinction makes what may be a long-shot gamble seem a sure thing. Indeed, by linking a few inferences together, some men are able to build themselves ladders with which to climb right out of the world of reality. Okay, let's take a quiz. Okay, now let's go over together and make sure we've got it in mind. John Phillips, the research director of a Midwestern food products firm, ordered a crash program of development on a new process. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was these new. Have you had any of these cornflakes with dehydrated strawberries? Have you had any? They're delicious. I don't see how in the world they do it, but once that strawberry has absorbed that moisture, it's just as good as a fresh one. Oh, they're on sale at all the food stores. And you can get them with peaches or blueberries. Pour it in the milk, they reconstitute and they're delicious. Now, I don't know whether this is what John Phillips did or not, but he was the research director of a Midwestern food products firm, ordered a crash program of development on a new process. He gave three of his executives authority to spend up to $50,000 each without consulting him. He sent one of his best men, Harris, to the firm's West Coast plant with orders to work on the new process immediately. Within 1 week, Harris produced a highly promising new approach to the problem. Okay, we got the facts in mind here? Now, if you want to just fold your sheet over, you notice that you have three choices in each question. True, false, or it doesn't say. Beg your pardon? You can look at the story. Yes, you can look at the story. Now, there are some ground rules on this. Let me give you the ground rules. Read the following story, sample story, and take for granted that everything it says is true. Read carefully because in spots, the story is deliberately vague. Don't try to memorize it since you can look back at it at any stage. Then read the numbered statements about the story and decide whether you consider each one true, false, or questionable. Circling the T means that you feel the statement is definitely true. Circling F means that you're sure it is definitely false. Circling the question mark means that you cannot tell whether it is true or false. If you feel doubtful about any part of a statement, circle a question mark. Take the statements in turn and do not go back later or change any of your answers. Do not reread any of the statements after you have answered them. Such altering or rereading will start the test. So, go down the line, but once you've made an answer, then that's it. Don't go back. Okay? Thank you. Okay, you ready to grade these? You don't have to hand them in, you can keep them. Okay, first one starts off real easy, doesn't it? Philip sent one of his best men to the West Coast plant. What's the answer?
True.
Very clear statement. It says, in about the middle of it, he sent one of his best men, Harris, to the firm's West Coast plant. Number two, Phillips overestimated Harris's competence. What do you have? Now, there's no clue in here at all, is it? Whether he did or he didn't. So it doesn't say whether he did or whether he didn't. Doesn't say that. Okay, third one. Harris failed to produce anything new.
False.
Okay, he did come up with a new process in a week. Is that what it says? Within 1 week. It produced a highly promising new approach. Now the question is, he failed to produce anything new. But did he come up with something new? Okay. That's what it says. He came up with a new approach. He came up with something new. In a week. The fourth one. Harris lacked the authority to spend money without consulting Phillips. Okay, we most of us agreed on that. Doesn't say whether anything about the financial arrangements with him. With one little complication that comes up in the next question. Five, only three of Phillips' executives had authority to spend money without consulting him. Yes, that's right. This is questionable. Because we know that three of them had authority, but we don't know anything about the rest of them. So we can't say that only three. Doesn't say anything about that.
Wait a minute, go there. Only three, and we don't know that there were more.
Well, we'll find out pretty soon. We don't know whether Harris was one of the three or not.
Can the answer is false to number five?
Five is questionable. Number six, the research director sent one of his best men to the firm's West Coast plant.
True.
Okay. Occasionally there's something clear in here, and it says he sent one of his best men, Harris, to the firm's West Coast plant. In fact, that's pretty close to the first question, isn't it? Okay, same. Phillips was the research director. Number seven. Three men were given authority to spend up to $50,000 each without consulting Phillips. What do you say? That's right. And then there's no indication in here that these three executives were men. They all three might have been women. Most companies have at least one woman in their research department in the food industry, don't they? Okay. Some of these are, the answer is hard to come up with, but it isn't on that, is it? If he'd have said three executives, it would be easy, wouldn't it? He says three men. False. Number eight? Yes, that's right. It's questionable because it doesn't say they're men. Excuse me, I shouldn't have said it was false. Well, if you want to exercise that license by then, that's right down the truth. Number eight, Phillips had a high opinion of Harris. Well, what's the man who made this test up? He says the story suggested, but it doesn't specify it. So it's questionable. Thank you, Brian. Actually, in two, you just, the information isn't there. In this one, there is a stronger suggestion that he did have. But you can't prove it from the story. He might have been trying to ease him out of the company through a failure. But he says one of his best men, so it suggests that. I think it leans that direction.
Yeah. Did he have very poor of him personally? Did he have the doctor?
Well, he says he one of his best men, and I think this could happen, that personally he hated him.
Yeah.
He had respect for his professional ability, perhaps. Okay, number nine. Only four people are referred to in the story. You don't know whether Harris was one of the three or not, do we? But he still doesn't say whether or not he was one of the three. If Harris was one of the three given authority to spend $50,000, this would be true, but the story does not specify whether he was one of those three. So you don't know how many people there are in the story. Do we? Okay. Number 10, Phillips was research director of a food processing firm. Products firm, yes. Uh-huh. That's exactly what it says up in the first sentence. Now, number 11, I think, is really unnecessary, but it's in here. While Phillips gave authority to three of his best men to spend up to $50,000 each, the story does not make clear whether Harris was one of these men. Now, this one's kind of naughty, so you can just decide for yourself what this is, because I think it's a repetition, as we said, of only four people referred to in the story. I think it's a weak question.
I have a question.
The answer is that it is questionable.
Because he didn't say that they were the best members. Sorry. That doesn't make it better. Harris is the only one who first was the best. One of the best.
Well, why don't you just leave out 11 and grade yourself on the first 10 and don't let anybody see your score. I don't hand it in. Now, this is just one of three tests, but if you got them all right but one, this suggests a strong awareness of the difference between observations and inferences. The next rating, this may be an indication that you do not mistake inference for observations very often. A third grade here would be, this suggests that you find yourself in trouble once in a while as a result of confusing inferences and observations. And the next one would be, this may be an indication that you may be in frequent difficulty over such confusion. And if you only got a couple right, such a score suggests a strong tendency to mistake your opinions for facts. Well, this is based on all three tests. Right here, I don't know how many there are. I don't think we'll take the other two. But based on all three tests, a score of 38 or better, right, in all three tests. So this is approximately a third of them. So we can't come up with an evaluation, which I don't want to do. Here, in this. Yes, this is the purpose in giving it, is to realize how quickly we jump to conclusions. We read a little simple story like this, and immediately we size up exactly what it says and would probably pattern our actions accordingly. Now, what did we say was the greatest cause of failure in leadership? Well, I said this is very important, but in the thing that I read from this survey. Now, information is a part of it in here. But it was a failure, an inability to size up the situation, to weigh the evidence and come up with the facts. Hey, Barry? Well, now this thing was put out by a pretty high-powered research group. Dr. William V. Haney of the Northwestern University School of Business, who also serves as a consultant and lecturer to the Air Force, the Internal Revenue Service, and many top business firms, has made a long study of the causes and results of such confusion. His findings can help you make valuable improvements in your judgment. So there's some of this that's deliberately loaded. This isn't just like an ordinary paragraph you would read. Yes?
Well, I think, too, that like in school, this is the kind of test we take all the time. I mean, they don't grade on what you know about something, but whether you can psych out the question, whether it's a trick question, or, you know, if you're thinking this way, this might help, too.
Well, if there's any application of what we have been studying here this morning, it would be this, that we are to be guided, first of all, by the facts in the situation. Is this not true? And the second thing is that we cannot base our judgment. We've got to have the courage to act in accordance with what the facts are, not act from prejudice or from expediency or social pressure or legality. I talk with people occasionally about financial matters. And as a couple came out to see me one day that I've known for a while, and they wanted to buy a larger house. Well, what's your present situation? Now this house is going to cost more. They had to have some money for down payment. And they're running in debt on their present income right now. Well, I couldn't see that they had a case in any direction. But they were actually wondering if there's any reason why they shouldn't go ahead on here. What do you think was influencing them?
Social pressure.
And expediency. They wanted to move to a place where that all three of their children would be in walking distance to their school district. But in finances, there's only two ways to improve your position. One way is to increase your income. The other is to decrease your expenses. So if you are not making ends meet and you can't do those one of those two things, then there's nothing to do about it. That's the only two avenues to improve your situation, increase your income or decrease your expenses. Now, those are facts, aren't they? But America is filled with people that are getting in debt, deeper and deeper in debt. Just can't face the facts. Can you think of any other applications we can make of this session? I think that that one of the places this comes is in this matter of social pressure. Now, I know a case we had in the Navigators not too long ago, where that Hootenanny evangelism seemed to be pretty successful in the East, some out in the West. Why don't we have a Hootenanny? You know, we'll be dragging our heels if we don't have a Hootenanny. That's a going thing in evangelism here. Well, I don't want to tell tales out of school, but one of these groups did have a Hootenanny. And all the reports that I ever got back that it was miserable. They didn't have any talent, or anybody knew how to conduct it. And once the thing got started, nobody knew how to stop it and rescue it. So the pressure that was on here, you know, it's going to look like we're dragging our heels. Unless we have one too, we've got to keep up with everybody else. So I would say the courageous thing to do is just recognize, now regardless of what the rest of people think, we don't have the resources to do this. We're just going to say no. Maybe we will drag our heels and get a poor reputation, but we can't do it. Period. So courage in my mind is not to be influenced by expediency or social pressure or legality.